My name is Dave Moore. On January 11th, 2000, I was a reporter for Manx Radio. At the time, I covered the Solway Harvester tragedy. You're about to hear from some of those who were involved in the search and recovery operation. I must warn you, some of the following content may be upsetting.
My name is John McCready. On 11th of January 2000, I was a member of the Royal National Lifeboat Institute in Douglas, serving on the Sir William Hillary lifeboat. I was sitting having my dinner at 18:30, and my pager was a task request, which means attend a lifeboat station, and it was immediate launch.
My name is Peter Cowan. On January 11th, 2000, I was crew member on Douglas lifeboat Sir William Hillary. I was sat in our dining room having tea with my wife, two children who were babies. The pagers went off, and my wife said to me, "Who the heck is out on a night like tonight?" I said, "It's got to be a false alarm." The week before, Ramsey had had a false alarm with an EPIRB going off. And I said, "Probably something like that." You don't do anything. All you do is grab your car keys, run out, straight out the door. So I can still remember what I had for tea. I had bangers and mash. We just finished and the children were quite happy. So I just had to say goodbye. Them days, there was no mobile phones, no AIS. Made my way down the boathouse as quick as I could. Turned up. Even then, you still don't know what has happened. It's just another call.
As soon as I got out of the house, it was blowing a real gale, 8, maybe even more. Got to the lifeboat station. The coxswain, Robert Corn, at that time, asked me to get my gear on. We all mounted the boat of Robert, Bernie Sale, mechanic, Peter Cowan.
I realised the gravity of the situation when Robert Corn, who was a coxswain at the time, said to me, "You're navigating. You don't get out of that chair unless I ask you to get out of that chair." And that's the point I knew that was something serious. So we headed out into the black. From what I can remember, we didn't have an exact location. There was a little bit sketchy. I think Ramsey were out. I think we heard Port St Mary being paged. There was a helicopter in the air. But that particular service call, we hadn't long had a GPS. Before that, we used to work off an old system of Decca. And I'd got my head round the GPS system really well, and I could navigate very well. So Robert had said to me, "Right, you're navigating." So Bernie Sale was the mechanic at the time. Unfortunately, Robert and Bernie have passed away since. John McCready was out with us that night, Phil Penketh, and we set off into the dark.
My name is Alan Hiscott. On January the 11th, 2000, I was senior Met officer at Rollsway. We'd had quite strong southerly winds for several days, which tend to generate quite a big swell up the east side of the island. On that day, we had southerly winds in the afternoon, it was 6 or 7, but we increased to a full gale in the evening.
We launched the boat. As soon as we were around the back of Douglas Head, we realised where we were going. It was 11 miles southeast of Ramsey. A horrendous seas, and we realised it was a trawler that was missing.
Around about 6 o'clock, 6:30-ish, one of the air traffic staff, Phil Richmond, came down to tell me that being an EPIRB, which is an emergency position indicating radio beacon, had gone off somewhere off Douglas. A few days before, there'd been a false alarm with one going off in the hangar, and he'd been sent to check it wasn't the false alarm, but he was good enough to drop into the Met office to tell me there was a search and rescue operation going on.
I've been out in rougher weather, but it was just violent, just really violent.
When we got to the position, we started our searches. Two of us got out on the main deck with searchlights, and 9 times out of 10, we couldn't see where we were going. We had goggles on, masks down, and waves were coming over the top of us. The Ben McCree was actually about a quarter of a mile away from us, and she was actually disappearing in the troughs. She was on her way to Haysham that night at the time of the call. It's at 27. And by the time she got out there, she was actually giving us shelter at the same time, looking herself. But the distance between her and I, we couldn't see her because of the swells were that bad. There must have been a 20, 30 foot swell.
We spoke to other boats in the area. I think the fleet auxiliary vessel Bayleaf was in the area. I think he came up to assist. They said the Ben McCree was right alongside us. I looked out the window in the black, couldn't see anything. And we must have been in a hole, 20, 25 foot hole of water. Then we popped up on top of a wave and the Ben McCree was just sat there looking at the chart table and working out where we were. Sometimes when you look up, you suddenly realise there's the car ferry right next to us.
The Ben searched for a while or two before she disappeared. There was another two lifeboats come round helping us.
We knew Ramsey were there, we knew Port St Mary were there, but because obviously the foul conditions, we couldn't physically see them.
And there was an auxiliary Royal Navy boat from fuel boat from Peel, the west coast of the island. And we searched and searched and searched.
My name is Captain Michael Brew, and on January the 11th, 2000, I was Director of Harbours. I was at home. Harbour Control at that time monitoring all that was going on, so they did the normal thing and call out everybody, and everybody was informed very early on what was unfolding. Part of my role was to look after Isle of Man Coast Guard, so they were mobilised and keeping Harbour Control fully briefed as to what was going on.
Around about 9 o'clock, two helicopters came in to refuel. One was a big yellow Sea King from RAF Valley. The other was an orange Sikorsky, I think, from the Irish Met Service at Weston near Dublin. It was interesting that the RAF crew came straight up to the Met Office to check the weather, whereas the Irish crew went to the security post, maybe for a cup of tea or maybe just to show their passports. I think the winchman from the RAF helicopter, he said that the sea was the worst conditions he'd actually been in. And he said it was much more comfortable being in the water collecting debris than hovering above in the waves and wind.
There was a helicopter right above us. It felt as if he was just on our shoulders, just giving us some light.
Got to about 9:30, and I was going off duty. Adrian Cowan came off the night shift. And I was driving home to north of Onchan, so I went the coast road and stopped on the loop road where White City used to be and watched the helicopter searching the light beams going backwards and forwards on the sea. They knew roughly where the boat was, and they were sweeping across looking for signs of life.
Eventually, we actually found the life raft. 2 o'clock in the morning, 1 o'clock in the morning, we actually found it. Actually, the helicopter spotted it first and then directed us towards it because it was drifting, but it hadn't actually inflated. The seals had actually opened.
We struggled getting it on board the boat. We improvised with a scrambler net because obviously it was full of water. It took six of us to get that on board.
It had opened but not fully inflated, and then we thought, this is really bad, when we didn't find any persons in the boat. We carried on our search all night, trying to find debris, looking with searchlights all over, parallel, up and downs, box square searches. All the vessels there were really intense searches, searchlights everywhere. Half the time we couldn't see each other's boat because of the weather was so severe. And I've been involved with a lifeboat about 27 years now, and I've never been in conditions like that before.
And we found other bits of debris, found a life ring, all sorts of little bits of mops and flops and, you know, bits that would have floated off the boat. And I think it's at the point where we started to realise that it was serious.
We came back into Douglas about 5:30 in the morning. We actually refuelled the boat, took the life raft off, and then a couple of extra crew come on, and myself and next of Peter went back out in the boat again.
My wife knew what was going on because Robert's wife, Mary, had been in touch with the people that were out there, obviously, because them days there was no mobile phones, no AIS. She didn't know where people were. So just to let her know I was fine, and just, you know, go and give the kids a little cuddle. And then we headed back out to sea. We changed crew. We took Robert's brother, Neil Corran, and he was on the Ben McCree that night. So he'd spent that night on the Ben McCree, then came out with us again. Daylight had arrived. The weather conditions had changed dramatically. Carried out another search pattern, and what we found, we just found pots and pots of little plastic, obviously what they must have used on the fishing boat, just debris everywhere. And it was that flat, you could see it for, we just picked it up and picked it up. And
we were carried on right through. The Coast Guard stood us down.
We came back, we rehoused about 4 o'clock on the 12th of January. And I think there was a realisation that was it. There was no survivors.
My name is Dudley Butt, and on January the 11th, 2000, I was Detective Chief Inspector in the Isle of Man Constabulary. Well, that evening I became aware that a boat had sunk 10 miles off the coast of the Isle of Man, a trawler called the Solway Harvester, in about 130 feet of water. And the next morning I was called in to be appointed as the senior investigating officer to investigate what had happened, because we have a duty to the coroner, usually with a death, to find out what happened. And my first job was I went down to the lifeboat house and spoke to the lifeboat crew who had been called out during the night. They'd found debris and they'd found a raft. I sat with them all morning and discussed what they'd seen and what they'd heard. A Navy vessel in the area, I think it was called the HMS Sandcastle, came to the area and they actually located the boat. So we knew, we had a location of where the boat was, so we knew where to look. We later learned, in the next couple of days, that a sister vessel of the Solway Harvest had been sent over by the owner, allegedly, to damage the Solway Harvest, to make it look as if it had been hit by something, or hit by a submarine, hit a container, or whatever. I think to try to cover up the fact that the boat was actually faulty, to try to make out the reason for its sinking was a collision rather than a defective vessel. And they dropped trawling gear over the side of the boat to try to damage the Solway Harvester, probably to make it appear that there'd been a collision or damage to the vessel. So once we knew that, we knew that something was amiss. So I went to see Mr. Moyle, the coroner. Mr. Moyle, as the coroner said, please investigate. We need to find out what really happened. So once Mr. Moyle had said, go ahead and investigate, my next job was to find out, how do we get this vessel out? How do we get the bodies out? So I went to see Mike Brew, the harbour master. In my mind, it was a simple job. It was 10 miles off, in 130 feet of water, roughly, send out a boat, some divers, and bring them out. But Mike Brew said, no chance. He said, first of all, it's too deep for ordinary divers. You need a proper diving gear with diving bells, etc. And the main point is there's about a 4 or 5 mile race knot out at that area, in that particular area. And he said, you need a vessel that can stay stationary over the area with motors either corner, basically, to keep it steady. Mike sort of threw a spanner in the works and said, it's not easy.
So our role in harbours was to facilitate what happened and to try and provide our knowledge and experience to people who, particularly like Dudley Butt, who had limited knowledge, and we tried to help.
So I then spoke to John Foster, who was then head of what was the civil defence, then emergency planning. John Foster, a very good man, and he had a genius for organising things. I sort of saw John and I said, what do we do? So he got in touch with various people to find out how we did it. And he came back and said, there are vessels with lifting gear that can do it. It will cost a lot of money and they can come here and do it. I went back to Mr. Moyle again, and Mr. Moyle said, yeah, we've got to do it because of this allegation of a possible crime. Meantime, we didn't know if the bodies were still on board because of the nature of the way it went down. So we needed to know the bodies were on board to make it a worthwhile exercise. So I was in touch with the Marine Investigation Branch in the UK, who were very helpful to a certain extent, and we're going to send over experts to give us a hand. But it was in our waters and our responsibility. And I spoke to Admiral Lang, his name was, and said we could do with a vessel coming over to examine the wreck to find out, are the bodies on board? And he said, sorry, we can't help you. It has to be a sea grave. It has to be left as it is. We don't set a precedent for British ships being lifted and raised because it could cost millions and millions. Say a boat sank in the middle of the Pacific, do we lift that as well? And I said, well, we're going to lift it as far as we can. We're the Alaman government, have our own government, our own. We need your help. And he said, no, we can't do it. I then went with John Foster to see Donald Gelling, then Chief Minister. And Donald Gelling was brilliant throughout the whole procedure. I told Donald Gelling the problem. I said, we need a lot of money. We need help from the UK to lift this vessel. And without those, we can't do it. And Donald listened to my story and John Foster's story. And he put his hand across his chest and he said, OK, Dudley, get them up. We'll pay for it. I didn't know Donald Gelling then at all. We then had that assurance from him he would help. Back to Admiral Lang again. Listen, Admiral Lang, we're going to do it. The Chief Minister's agreed to do it. We're going to pay for it. We need your help. He again said, sorry. I said, please, can you find out, can it be done? He rang me back later and said, the Deputy Prime Minister in the UK was John Prescott. And he was also the Minister of Transport. And he said, I've spoken to John Prescott and he's inclined to help, but he wants to speak to your Chief Minister. So I had to fix up. Donald Gelling was at some function down south somewhere. I had to fix up a phone call between John Prescott and Donald Gelling. And John Prescott had been a seaman in the seamen's unions. He'd been involved to some extent in a vessel called the Derbyshire, which sank somewhere in the Pacific, and he was annoyed at the fact that those bodies hadn't been recovered. And John Prescott, again, I'm going to say in hindsight, a good man, him and Donald Gelling agreed they would send a vessel to have a look. Donald got Prescott to intervene, and John Prescott sent a vessel, which was then in Aberdeen. We knew where it was. We knew the vehicle we needed. It was called the Mansell 18. He agreed it could come to the Isle of Man. And the Mansell 18 set sail that night to come here. It took nearly 3 days to get here. When it arrived, we put on one of our detectives, Guy Sutton, went on board with it. And they went out and they used remote cameras and sort of like mini submarine they had. They could see three bodies in the wheelhouse area. So we knew we had bodies on board. We knew then we had a reason to actually try to recover the bodies and to examine the wreck. So thanks to John Prescott's intervention, it was all go. We then had to go to Tynwald. Donald Gelling had to go to Tynwald, and they had a debate about giving us £1 million to raise the vessel. We didn't know what it would cost, but that was what they allowed for. And it went through only one vote against, I think, and it was agreed in Tynwald that the money would be given. So again, Donald Gelling was very instrumental in making that happen. The Mansell 18 had found those three bodies. We then got in touch with John Foster from the Civil Defence, got in touch with the firm, and they had a vessel which had a motor at either corner of the boat, a big vessel with big heavy lifting gear. And that came here within about a week to 10 days, that was here to the wreck.
My name is Captain Stephen Carter, and on the 11th of January 2000, I was the pilot for all the harbours in the Isle of Man and also the owner of the Laxey Towing Company. The government decided to charter two ships to try and raise the wreck, and they were a North Sea diving ship called the CS Well Servicer, which had two large cranes on and all sorts of other facilities, and a smaller oil rig supply vessel called the Scotian Shore. And a plan was made to charter these two ships and bring them to the Isle of Man to try and raise the wreck of the Solway Harvester and recover the bodies. They also brought in a number of experts, Captain Michael Brew, the Chief Harbour Master, his deputy, Captain Philip McParlan, and a very experienced and senior diving manager who worked in the North Sea, but from Laxey, Kendrick Holsall, and various others, along with Detective Chief Inspector, I think he was at the time, Dudley Butt.
And they had a team of divers on board, and they were divers that went down with the full diving bells, the full kit. They weren't just like sub-aqua divers. This would be early February. They spent over a week there at the scene. We put on board two of our detectives, Andy Haddock, who was a Scenes of Crime officer, and Roger Clare, who was a detective sergeant in Scenes of Crime, a good friend of ours, and did a lot of good work on this. They were on board for nearly 10 days altogether, plus four firemen from here to help with the bodies when they recovered them. They were on board that vessel for 10 days altogether, stuck at sea for 10 days. The weather turned, as it was always bound to, unfortunately, and they had several problems. Gear broke, storms were too rough, things went wrong.
The first plan was to try and raise the wreck of the Solway Harvester from the seabed with the bodies of the deceased fishermen actually left on board. The CS Well Servicer had two large cranes, and they brought in a team of specialist divers, and they initially got slings around the wreck, and they tried to lift it, but it proved to be too heavy for the cranes to lift. We were out in their tug supporting the Well Servicer. My understanding is that they did manage to lift it a certain distance off the seabed, but it was proving too much for the cranes, and there were one or two hitches, and so it was put back down onto the seabed. It was a bit more complicated than that, but basically it was too heavy for the cranes to lift.
We hoped to lift them out at the weekend, early February. We actually flew over, all the families came over, and I went to a meeting with them, Donald Gelling, myself, and my sergeant, Mike Duke, who also did a lot of good work on this. We sat in a room at the Mount Murray, and we tried to tell these families, who were all grieving, what we were going to do. And one of the spokesmen of the families, who was a bit of an angry man, he stood up and said, "We know what happened. We know that one of the British Navy submarines has hit it and damaged it, and it's all down to the British Navy, and you're going to do what the British Navy say. You know, you're going to cover it all up." And he was angry, and they were shouting at us, literally shouting at us, and some were crying. I turned to Donald Gelling and said, Mr. Gelling will tell you we're a separate nation. We won't do anything the British want us to do. We'll investigate it properly. And Donald Gelling said, I assure you this will happen. And he said, tell you what, let's go into the bar and adjourn and have a drink and we'll talk about it. And so we went into the bar and Donald said to me, who's going to pay for this? And I said, we'll sort it out later. And we sat them down at tables in the bar and brought them all a drink. And we went round table to table, me and Donald, in his very Manx way, reassured them what we were going to do and put them at ease. And it really worked quite well. And the angry man later became quite friendly. He got on our side in the end. That went reasonably well, but we then couldn't get the bodies out. It was just, the weather was too bad. Couldn't get the boat up. Things broke. There's hawsers broken, all sorts of stuff.
So I recall sitting, going home really late one night as I came into Garwick Bay and thinking, what on earth are we going to do next? And it was a very strange event overall because it was really groundbreaking. And there was a lot going on which nobody was sure was going to work. And then the weather was pretty grim at times. That, plus the normal risks of working in the sea with currents and waves, made life very difficult. So there was a lot of talking about what can we do next, how do we do this, how do we do that.
The government, once again under Donald Gelling, decided to change tack, if you like, and they realised that actually raising the wreck was going to be more difficult than perhaps they had first envisaged, and therefore they decided to try and recover the bodies.
Listening into some of the divers' conversations was incredibly eye-opening. There were things that you could only imagine were actually trying to picture the divers searching in the inside the vessel. Beggars belief, really does what they managed to achieve.
Eventually, we were coming to a bit of an impasse. And one of the divers from the boat, who I believe was a very religious man from the Orkneys, I've never met him, I don't even know his name, he said to the crew, I would like to go down and I'll get them out, get the bodies out. Couldn't raise the boat, but he said, I'll get the bodies out. Big discussion. We had a control room of at-home affairs. We're all sitting there. Big decision had to be made. This is risky, a man on his own going down to get the bodies out. Do we allow it? And we eventually agreed, yes, let him do it. And he went down to get the bodies. We already knew there were three in the upper decks, which we'd seen, and they'd been sort of tied safe and secured. There's a video of this, and I've seen the video. And the diver goes down, and he goes down into this crew quarters at the very bottom. And when he goes in, you can see three lads there. One is wearing a Celtic shirt. A fellow, you can see the Celtic shirt. He goes in, it's quite clear. And as he moves around, it gets a bit muddy, so the picture fades. But he found three people. So there was still one missing, because there were seven on board. We get a message back. He's found six altogether. And there's still one missing, and that was our worst nightmare, really. And he said, the message came back, I'm going to search the engine area now, the engine rooms, and I'll come back again. And he searched the rest of the boat, still no sign. He goes back into the crew quarters again, where these three are, to have another look, and doesn't find anything else. And as he comes out, you can see on the video, he climbs a little metal ladder to get out of that crew quarters, and you see a hand flop out from behind the ladder. And the seventh man, it was a lad called Wesley Jolly, only just turned 17. He was stuck behind the ladder, and he hadn't seen him when he walked in. It was behind him. When he walked out the second time, this hand flopped out as if to say, I'm here. And he'd found the seven. And we got the message that all seven had been found, and that was a huge relief, because say to the family, we've got six of your family, but not one. It would have been devastating for them.
The diver that eventually found the last crew member, he probably was beyond his limits, actually, but would not give up. So it was incredibly emotional when they found the last one. They got them all out, and that was a huge relief. And you could tell that even in the professional, sort of almost bland communications that we're hearing, you could tell the emotion was very much affecting everybody. A diver would tell you more than I know, but at a certain depth, they're time limited as to how long they can actually work at that level and not get the bends, as they're commonly known. They were pushing the limits of what was safe and possible, but they were very determined to find them.
And you have to say that the divers from the Well Servicer, under the instruction of Kendrick Halsall, did a remarkable job, not a very nice job, going aboard and recovering the bodies, which were brought aboard the CS Well Servicer.
I then went into town, where I knew the families were in town shopping, in effect, and I saw the coach they were using outside the Sefton. It was driven by McGee. He used to play for Bellew, a lad called McGee. I forget his name now. And I said, where are they all? He was with the coach, and he said, they're all in town shopping. They're coming back at 2. So I thought, right. And I went to the Sefton Hotel and I said, please, can I have a room? I need to, urgent room. They came back at 2 and we got them into the atrium. The atrium had been built by then, into a room just off that. Organised coffee, etc. And there was myself, Mike Duke, my sergeant, Alan Bell, who was then in charge of Home Affairs. He was the Minister of Home Affairs. And Will Greenhow, who was the accountant or the treasurer, later chief secretary. And we sat there, we got them all sat down and we said, we've got some sort of, didn't quite say good news, bad news, but we've got some good news that we've found the bodies and they're all there, you know, we've got them all. And I've got to say, as I told the story, it was like bad news, good news. As I told the good news, they're all there. I started to cry, as did all of them, as did Alan Bell, as did my sergeant. He was not prone to crying. It was so emotional, the most emotional moment of my career, to say to them, we've got them all out safe. Everybody was in tears and they were so relieved. While all this was going on, we had the world's press here throughout late January, early February. And every night or every day I was doing a press conference and there were like 20 film cameras on us and I was doing this proper high-grade press stuff. And then the evenings I'd go and meet them in the Empress Hotel in a bar and tell them the background to it all, give them the real story and tell them what we're actually doing. But then we still had the press conferences. And I was assigned Daphne Kane from Home Affairs as my sort of aide, so as a, to give me some journalistic input. So she broke her teeth on that. I think she was quite new then. But she worked with me a bit on doing press releases and stuff. So I had Daphne with me for those 2 weeks. During that night, or that evening, this diver had gone down. He bagged all the bodies up and he got them up and we had a vessel called, like a little container ship, had gone out to the wreck and they loaded the bodies on the container vessel and then brought them in that night. And that was be February the 4th, I think, the Friday night.
Now, the intention was that the well servicer was going to steam into Douglas and bring the bodies ashore at Douglas. However, by the time the last body was on board, the wind had started to freshen considerably from the southwest. And I spoke to the captain. By this time, I should say that I'd brought the well servicer in and out of Douglas several times, so I knew the captain. We discussed the weather conditions and the difficulties of berthing the vessel in Douglas in the weather conditions. And because obviously I have the local knowledge, which is the whole point of pilots in the first place, I made the suggestion that if I was to steam to Laxey Bay in the Scotian Shore, the supply boat, and the well servicer steamed to Laxey Bay, it would be calm up there in Garwick Bay at the south end of Laxey Bay and comparatively sheltered from the gale, and we would be able to put the two ships alongside and transfer the bodies to the Scotian Shore, which was a much smaller ship, but much easier to get into Douglas and berth. And this is what actually happened. And then the detectives who were accompanying the bodies for the reasons of continuity of evidence, obviously, they transferred as well, as did various other people involved in it. And then once everybody was on board the Scotian Shore, we set off to Douglas. And I have to say that it was not a nice trip down to Douglas, because the tide was ebbing, which means that the direction of the tide was running from north to south, but the wind was blowing from south to north, so it made a very, very steep and uncomfortable sea. And I think that the poor detectives were not at all well on the way down to Douglas.
I was on the quay down there waiting for them to come in, and we had Dr. Christian, who was the doctor from Peel, who was our police surgeon. And as the bodies come in, he had to look at each one to certify them as being dead. The fireman who'd been on board the well server had come to shore as well with it. So the fireman and myself and two or three other people, we were lifting the bodies out of this container. And we had coffins arranged from funeral directors to take them away.
We berthed the Scotian Shore on the Victoria Pier, and the bodies were craned off one by one, and the government had arranged for a lone Scottish piper to be playing a lament on the pier, and it was entirely appropriate and extremely dignified.
There was a big crowd there. There was a piper, Barry Edgerton. One of the Edgerton lads was playing his pipes on the gantry at the top, and the families were up there with him on the gantry as we brought the bodies in. The bodies were in a reasonable state, to be honest. They'd been in the sea for 3 weeks, but it was very cold, and they'd been, in effect, preserved. And we then took them away to have postmortems, spent the night doing the postmortems.
The biggest event, as it worked out, once the bodies had been recovered, and the huge relief that everybody felt that they actually found all of them, and bringing them ashore in a way that met the needs of the family and the crew themselves, that was quite a stressful time, because the media all over this, nobody could move at all. The government chartered a Manx Airlines plane and went to Scotland to pick up the families, and we were kept very much in the loop as to where they were, where the aircraft was, the timings, because we had to get the families from Ronaldsway to Douglas Harbour as quickly as we could, and hopefully outside of the view of the public and the media. That was achieved. The families were actually in the walkway between the two piers with the lights out, so they could see what was going on without being seen themselves. And that was an incredibly emotional time, and something which I think the families appreciated in the end.
The next morning, I went to saw Michael Moyle, the coroner, and told him the results of the postmortems, which indicated there had been some smoke in the engine room, that the engine had died off because of the water inhalation. Mr. Moyle wasn't very pleased with what he called the circus down at the landing pier as the bodies were brought in, because he thought that was a bit over the top, the ceremonial aspects of it. But I think for the families there themselves, it probably was quite an appropriate thing. For me, I was busy doing other things, and we were actually dealing with, I'm afraid, dead bodies and the consequence of those. In fact, there was a young policeman came along. The lads had been on the boat for weeks, or for 10 days or more, were actually doing the physical lifting and the firemen, and I thought it was unfair they should be doing all this now. So this young policeman came along, and I said, "How long have you been on?" And he said, 6 months, and I meant, how long had he been working that night? And I said, "Could you give a hand moving these bodies?" He moved the first one, then he disappeared, and we never saw him again that night. Policemen in my day, we were used to dealing with bodies all the time. We used to have to strip them and move them, etc. But the current policeman never hardly ever touches a body or sees a body. I think he was a bit shocked by what he saw. The postmortem was done overnight. Cause of death were drowning, etc. And then we had to start an investigation as to how it happened. The families went home that weekend. And during the next week, well, they had the funerals of the boys who died. And I went away to the funerals, but with Mike Duke, my sergeant, as did Alex Downey and Donald Gelling. They went away from the government. And the people in the Isle of Wight were so grateful to the Isle of Man for what we'd done. And the funerals were amazing, because the people were so supportive of us and were so grateful for what we did and for the Isle of Man. There's a pub there called the Steam Packet on the quay, and we went there and had a few drinks with the families, and it was an amazing occasion. Very emotional, very, very moving. More funerals the next day at Whittorn itself. We went into a pub called the Railway in Whittorn, and we were told by the local police, don't go there, it's a bit of a no-go area, it's a bit rough. And I've got to say, some of Whittorn is rough. The people are very poor and there weren't many jobs. And these lads working on the Solway Harvester were lucky to have a job. And financially, the whole area was fairly poor at the time. And we go into the railway pub, and there is this man who was a bit stroppy with us the first time. He was like the godfather of the area, a bit of a strong character, put it mildly, I suppose. He may have had a history, I suspect. But he was there, and we were talking to him, and we had a couple of pints with him and some sandwiches. And I go in the toilet at one point, and there's one of these Scottish lads there, and he bangs into me deliberately in the toilet. He says, I effing hate the poor. I say, hate you. Hate you. And he's pushing me, and he says, but thanks for getting the boys up. So the next thing is, we're in there talking away, and there's a bit of an atmosphere, not too bad. And I said to my colleague, I think we'd better go now. And then just as that happened, the door bursts open, and a young blonde lad shoots through the door, falls on the ground, His wrist is cut open and he's squirting blood in the air. His wrist is, his artery's gone in his wrist. Mike and I move into first aid mode, and Mike gets a beer towel and he tries to stem the blood. And I'm asking this lad, what's happened? You know, what's happened to you? Because I'm asking questions, the crowd get a bit angry with us. You know, leave him alone, leave him alone. And so we stem the wounds and we decide to leave. We had to go back to the Isle of Witton for some funeral ceremony down the Isle of Witton, which is about 5 miles away. Ask this lad questions, get sort of no replies, and decide to leave, discretion the better part of valour. So we walked out of the door, trail of blood up the road to a house, and there's a house there with a window smashed in. An English chap out there, and this English chap had been the boyfriend of the mother of one of the lads who died, and he wasn't well liked in the area. So I spoke to him, I said, what's happened here? He said, oh, young Davy so-and-so has just come in and punched my window and run off. And I said, oh, okay, have you called the police? He said, I have, but there'll be ages coming. And I said, we are the police. He said, oh, where have you come from? I said, the Isle of Man. He said, that was quick. So I said, if you agree to take no further action and I get this sorted, will you call the police off? He said, okay. Went back to the pub, saw the godfather and said, look, can you agree to pay for this damage to the window and we'll sort it all out? And he said, yeah, we'll sort it all out. So we left on good terms in the end, and they sorted out the cost of the window. But that was a small incident. There were other incidents as well, but it's part of the story. Once we got the bodies out, and the thing was then, how do we get the boat out? And they tried again, but they couldn't lift the boat. It was decided to leave it until the better weather.
The government then decided, at that time of year, it was pointless trying to continue with the vessels that they had, raising the wreck. And so everything was then put on hold until the summer.
Meantime, we carried on investigations. We had a couple of lads working in Witton area doing some investigations. I went over a few times with Alastair Montgomery, our then government prosecutor. We met there, procurator fiscal. We agreed terms of how we would prosecute and how we would do inquests, etc.
And the government chartered from a Belgian salvage company called Scaldus Salvage a large floating crane called the Norma, which was self-propelled in short distances but was towed up here by a big ocean-going tug. And then the Norma went out to site, and I was piloting the Norma out of the harbour, and then we were going out with it in air tugboat, the Wendy Ann, to stand by and assist if required. And eventually, after a few days, the Belgians, who were very skilled in this, managed to get slings round the wreck, and the crane on the Norma was a much bigger crane than the combined lifting capacity of the two cranes on the CS Well Servicer. And the Norma was able to lift the wreck of the Solway Harvester to the surface.
Investigation went on, and then in June, we got the lift done. When I say we, I wasn't on board. I had been on board, but wasn't there at the time. They lifted it up, and I went to Ramsey, where they came in.
The intention was to take the Solway Harvester eventually to the shipyard at Ramsey and put it on the slip so that it could be examined by the investigators, the marine investigators, to decide what caused the accident. The Norma arrived in Ramsey Bay. I went out in tug the Wendy Ann, and we had another smaller tug, the Lonnon, went out. And the intention was for us to tow it into Ramsey Harbour. But before we could do that, the Solway Harvester was still hanging from the crane, but partially in the water. And I then had to go aboard the Solway Harvester and go through it from stem to stern with the Belgian salvage superintendent, in order to make sure that there were no serious leaks which would possibly cause it to sink again in Ramsey Bay before it actually got into the harbour. And I have to say that it wasn't really terribly nice climbing through the ship where 7 fishermen had lost their lives. But anyway, it had to be done. And there was a little, tiny little leak round the stern post, but it was only a trickle and certainly nothing that worried me that there was going to be any problems taking it into the harbour at Ramsey. So once that was agreed and I signed the release papers on behalf of the government of the Isle of Man to take it over, we connected the two tugboats and then slowly towed it in the evening into the harbour at Ramsey.
It was a still lovely summer's night, and it was packed. The crowd, there must have been 2,000 or 3,000 people on the quayside there at Ramsey, and it came in dead still and calm.
When the Norma arrived in Ramsey Bay, unlike the earlier operations, the weather was absolutely beautiful. It was a wonderful evening, very little wind, sunny. But the amazing thing was, there was absolute silence. Nobody was talking. and the only thing that you could really hear was the exhaust of the two tugboats bringing it in and manoeuvring it. And then, along with the Harbour Board's workboat, the Tawarushti, we put it alongside the Key and Ramsey, and then a couple of days later, the Tawarushti moved it up and put it on the slip at the shipyard so the investigations could begin.
And when you get it onto the ramp, it's actually a big piece of kit. It's like three stories, in effect, and you get inside it, it's huge. And we found that through experiments, we actually got a model built in a dummy down at Plymouth. We got a model built in a simulated sea in Plymouth. And what had happened was it had shipped water. It hadn't been maintained properly. It had loose hatch covers. The inner linings were soaked. There's like fibre in between the linings, and then it got soaked. It was tons heavier than it should have been. They put a new superstructure above, which is out of sync to what it should have been. It was a faulty vessel and had been for years. It was soaked through. The previous trip, they'd gone out. One of the lads who hadn't been on the second time gave evidence that he'd had to wade through waist deep in the water to unplug what they call... It's a filter thing in the bottom of the boat, which gets rid of the rubbish, and then I got blocks. And he had to undo it to release all the water, etc. And that was through waist deep. That was the trip before in December. It's happened again. Water had come in. It got unstable. The weather was very bad that night. It was probably a force 8, force 9. It apparently, from what we worked out, it sank and went nose down and hit the seabed, nose down, and crumpled the nose. We were able to find that within the crumble of the nose, we found nuts and bolts and bits of loose debris, etc., which meant the allegation was it had been hit by a submarine or something or a container or something. Had it been hit while it was floating upright, that stuff wouldn't have been found in the crumple zones. When it had gone down, stuff had shifted forward into the very front or the prow, and that had been crumpled, and in that was some of the debris, so we could prove that it had actually gone nose down, and then the damage had been done hitting the seabed, not by anything hitting it, which had been the allegation, that it had been a submarine or a container or some other vessel. So we were able to prove that that's how it sank, and we were able to prove that the vessel hadn't been maintained.
Well, the Solway Harvester lay at Ramsey Shipyard for some months until all the investigations were completed. And then Captain Michael Brew asked me if we could tow it down to Douglas, because it was a little bit in the way, to be honest, a limited space up there. And there was a place in Douglas which wouldn't impinge on other shipping movements in the harbours around the Isle of Man. And so we then connected it up and towed it out of Ramsey, and we towed it down to Douglas Harbour. The government kept Laxey Towing Company paid on a retainer to look after it, to check the moorings and occasionally pump it out because the rainwater would get down below, and generally look after it. On two occasions we had to move it to the King Edward Pier so that the Deemster and the advocates and the jury in the court cases could go aboard and go down below, so that people who didn't understand boats and ships, the various parts of it, could be actually explained to them. And I was down below there explaining what the various parts of the ship were that were mentioned in the reports and everything. And eventually, when all that had finished, it was deemed that it was no longer necessary to keep the vessel as evidence for a court case. All the parties agreed that the vessel could be disposed of, and it was getting in a fairly parlous state. It had actually sunk on its moorings because it had been there so long that the steel had worn away on the bottom and put a hole in it. That was not a major problem. And eventually the government went out to tenders, and the Laxey Towing Company was successful in tendering for dismantling the ship, and we moved it over to the other side of the harbour again, and then it took us about 6 weeks to cut it up. But one of the conditions of the tender was that nothing was allowed to be saved. They didn't want any souvenir hunters wanting a part of the vessel, so the condition of it was that everything had to be properly disposed of, and that was exactly the case. And so, in fact, in February 2014, we completed the demolition, which was just over 14 years after the vessel sank. The Solway Harvester was a steel vessel. It had various wooden linings in the hold and things. The wood was all cut out and burnt so that there were no remains. The steel was cut into sections and shipped off the Isle of Man to scrap merchants in the United Kingdom. And so we made the best endeavours. Nobody really knew where it was going to in the United Kingdom except me and the people that we were dealing with. that's as much as you could really do to stop people trying to get any macabre souvenirs.
In the end, we had a trial of, and I'd just about retired by then, we had a trial, jury trial in Douglas. We had an English Deemster, we had an English prosecutor, and English defence barristers as well. And we had a trial for manslaughter of the owner, Richard Gidney. The trial went well, up to a certain point, and I know one of the jurors who told me they were ready to convict. But about two-thirds of the way through the trial, they discovered that they were prosecuting using the English standards of manslaughter rather than the Manx version of manslaughter. And the Deemster had to ask the jury to return a plea of not guilty. In England, they have a corporate manslaughter charge. In the Isle of Man, we don't. And they prosecuted to the standard of the English one, but it didn't fit the Manx version of manslaughter. So, later the AG, Attorney General John Cole, issued a statement to Tumult about why it had been abandoned. I think that's on record somewhere. So it was just a technicality, really. Then Mr. Moyle, as coroner, tried to get an inquest going with Mr. Gidney to come to give evidence. And he eventually refused to give evidence, and he wouldn't attend. In the end, he escaped any retribution. We understand that on the day after the accident happened, he paid every member of the family of those who died £7,500. And we can't say what conditions they were on giving them that money, but he paid them that money the day after, which is one of the reasons which triggered our suspicions, plus that with the damage being done. The other skipper who tried to damage the boat was also prosecuted for that damage, but that wasn't revealed to the jury in the trial here. The saga was really about poor maintenance of ships, quick turnarounds, staff of very, very sort of poor kids being used to make money for owners, being abused in a way, I think, when you look at the life histories of those lads. It was all about making money. And most of these disasters are about money in the end.